Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, sick people.
Creating optimal health.
Small changes that can add up.
A workout that I can do pretty much anywhere.
Good health.
Okay, today we continue our series, DIY Health Checkup. This summer, we've been talking with Newsweek health reporter Kate Daly about getting back to the basics of health and how to take control of our bodies when it comes to basic eating, exercise, and finding a good doctor. But how about how we control our minds? You know, when it comes to mental health, it can seem like the situation is out of our hands. And although more than 55 million Americans suffer from a mental health issue, only a quarter of us will seek treatment. Now, Kate Daly, as we said, is a health reporter for Newsweek, and she's here with us to unpack some statistics about access to mental health care and how we can make sure to take care of this aspect of our health. We're also going to be talking to Dr. Richard McNally. He's a psychology professor at Harvard University. He's going to be joining us from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, What is Mental Illness? Kate, we're going to start with you. I mean, obviously, things have improved from the days when there was a real stigma surrounding people who tried to better their mental health. But what evidence is there that there's still some sort of stigma attached?
Well, the stigma we're seeing now is more of a soft stigma. No one really thinks that schizophrenia is caused by people being touched by the devil or that it's due to some sort of moral failing. But we're still seeing people being very reluctant to embrace mental illness or accept mental illness in their own lives. There was a study done by the Department of Health and Human Services that showed that the majority of people would rather tell potential employers that they had been convicted of a crime and spent time in jail than having spent time in a mental hospital.
Why would that be?
Well, we're seeing a lot of kind of stigma on the other side. We see employers who don't want to hire people who have mental illnesses. One in three people who have suffered a severe mental illness report that they've been turned down for a job or even that job offers have been rescinded once the diagnosis has been made clear. And these are people whose mental illnesses don't interfere with their job skills at all, that they are able to do the job, that their illness doesn't interfere with their job at all, but still there's this stigma that has a lot of people afraid, and that gets in the way of treatment.
Now, but the Paul Wellstone Act, which I believe was passed in 2008, that goes into effect this week. That was supposed to reduce this public stigma. Talk about what that is.
Yeah, the Wellstone Act actually went into effect on July 1st of this year, and that is an act, it's the Wellstone Mental Health and Addiction Equity Act.
It's the Parity Act, right?
The Parity Act, exactly. And what that says is that insurers can't treat mental health any different than physical health. So gone are the days where they say, well, you only have 10 appointments per year with a psychologist, or you have to pay a $20 copay for your primary care physician, but a $40 copay for your psychiatrist. So it's saying, in the eyes of insurers, mental health and physical health need to be billed the same and need to be treated.
Dr. McNally, I want to go to you. You have this book coming out called What is Mental Illness? I'm thinking just the fact that you have a title like that tells us something about how hard it is to identify when someone needs help.
Well, yeah, that's certainly the case, because mental illness spans a very wide range of conditions. And just as dermatologists treat everything from skin cancer to warts, mental health professionals treat everyone from schizophrenia, those with schizophrenia, to those with a fear of heights. So it's a very wide range of conditions. And we also get sort of a fuzzy boundary between mental distress and mental disorder. Mm. That's where a lot of the controversial issues arise. So, for example, with people with social anxiety disorders, is that just merely shyness exaggerated, or is it truly a mental disorder where something has gone wrong with a person's mind that's producing suffering and impairment?
So how do you help someone figure out where that line is between, say, something situational maybe and something where, boy, I need help?
Well, there's several sort of rough rules of thumb, so to speak, that can help people. One is certainly the amount of suffering that's causing. Two is the duration of the problem. If it continues to persist despite one's efforts to try to overcome it. And three, whether it's producing impairment in a person's life, actually interfering with family life, with work life, and so forth.
Hey, Kate, what do we know about how different demographics or groups of people experience mental illness and how they might experience it differently?
That's a great question. And earlier in the show, you read an email from a reader who said that they were only diagnosed after they spoke to a physician of color who was able to identify their symptoms. And that's something that we see. It's a issue in all aspects of healthcare, whether it's a podiatrist or a dermatologist, that you see these cultural differences. But in psychiatry and psychology, it's especially strong. About 40% of white Americans who are suffering from depressive disorder don't receive treatment. But when we talk about African Americans, Latinos, or Asian Americans, that number jumps up to about 60%. And primary care physicians are also not as good at detecting mental distress in patients of color. So it's something where there is a big divide.
All right. Now, Dr. McNally, I want to end with you here. Talk about what new therapies are on the horizon that you think will maybe perhaps make it easier for more people to get effective treatment.
Well, there are some of the more interesting therapies that have developed very recently. For example, for anxiety disorders, there's something called attentional training, which is really quite new, and it has several studies in support of it. People with anxiety disorders tend to selectively attend to threatening or disturbing information in their environment, and there's been some very simple programs devised by investigators such as Colin McLeod and Ada Amir, who have used computer-based methods to help people retrain their attention, and half of the people who've undergone such programs versus a placebo treatment have, in fact, lost the diagnosis. And so now there's some attempts to make it more broadly available. For example, my graduate student, Phil Enoch, has developed sort of an iPhone application testing whether this actually can be used, made more portable. So we'll see how this goes. But this is one of the more interesting breakthroughs, I think, that has happened recently.
Let's hope they use the iPhone 3 there. Dr. McNally, I'm going to have to let you go. Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, forthcoming book is What is Mental Illness? Kate Daly, health reporter from Newsweek, and coming in to help us with DIY health checkup time.
We want you to keep your stories on mental health coming. Stefaniel from New York writes to our site, I have Medicaid. I was depressed while pregnant and tried to find a therapist, but was told the only way I could get individual therapy was to be admitted to the hospital after attempting suicide. Apparently, the only options available to poor people are group therapy and or medication. We want your stories on thetakeaway.org. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.